Warnings. This event is free and takes place at the screening room. Save your spot today by visiting agnes.queensu.ca.
February 13th is World Radio Day, where millions around the globe celebrate the medium which touches so many lives. All across this country, Canadians are celebrating too, including Farm Radio International and the National Campus and Community Radio Association, with a live broadcast through CKCU-FM from Ottawa. Learn more and participate in World Radio Day at worldradioday.ncra.ca on February 13th and catch the live stream.
Danger, danger. The following contains explicit content. Please use caution while you are tuned in.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Kevin Staples.
And you're listening to Rainbow Country
with Mark Terra.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the persons appearing on the program.
Today on Rainbow Country, a spotlight on a new gay documentary, Studio One Forever. And joining me to talk about the film is the film's award-winning director and producer, Mark Saltarelli, and award-winning writer, actor, producer, and not to mention funny person, Bruce Phalange. That and more in episode 429, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland, Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So, today, a spotlight on a new gay documentary called Studio One Forever, a film about a West Hollywood gay bar that, in the 1970s, was the inspiration for the iconic Studio 54. Joining me to talk about Studio One Forever is the film's award-winning director and producer, Mark Saltarelli, and award-winning writer, actor, producer, Bruce Phalange. Plus, in Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house, and on this episode, I'm featuring some classic house, a trans artist set, and more. All that lies ahead as we start Journey 429 through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, British author Adam Smith reads from his gay history book, Deep Sniff, A History of Paupers and Queer Futures. By the way, the reading is accompanied by the parody song, Just a Quick Sniff of Paupers, from drag duo Cookie and Kashida.
When I was just a lad, I learned that anal sex was bad. The church said it was a dirty, rotten sin. But then I learned from other guys that no matter what the size. There's a simple trick to help you take that tick. Just a quick snip of poppers helps the penis slide right in. The penis slides right in, you can take it with a grin. Just a quick snip of poppers helps the penis slide right in the most delightful way.
In the winter of 1866, actually, while a medical student in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, Brunton met a patient called William H. This young man was only 26, but already had trained as a blacksmith, and then switched to tollkeeper. His first job may have required too much exertion for him to continue, because Brunton's notes reveal that William suffered from heart trouble. When Brunton met him, William had recently been hit by a dull, heavy pain about the left nipple every 3 days or so, lasting for at least half an hour. The pain had come on after years of infrequent attacks ever since he'd suffered from rheumatism as a child. After a three-week hospital stay earlier in the spring, William was back just before Christmas. Doctors gave him aconite, which slows the heart rate, and digitalis. When neither worked, Brunton gave him brandy. The strong stuff didn't help either, so there was only one thing for it. The experiment was not a stab in the dark. Brunton acted in a way that was consistent with his wishes to take basic research from the lab to the bedside, and only with a decent understanding of the actual effect in the body. He had read the work of another scientist, Richardson, that amyl nitrite dilated blood vessels, and had even discussed the effect with his colleague in Edinburgh, Arthur Gamgee, who had made some unpublished measurements of this effect. Brunton obtained some amyl nitrite from Gamgee, who made it for him, and consent for an experiment from his supervising physician. And this is how Brunton came to give his patient William amyl nitrite. On March the 12th, 1867, Brunton observed, "The pain came on as usual at 3 a.m. A few drops of nitrite of amyl were put on a towel and inhaled by the patient. The primary effect noticed was a suffusion of the face, and the patient felt a glow over his face and chest. The pain disappeared almost simultaneously with the occurrence of these phenomena, but returned in 3 minutes. He then inhaled 5 drops more. The pain again disappeared and did not return.
I met this guy once in a bar who took me outside to his car. He spread my cheeks and tried to ram it in. I screamed, no, it's too big. He said, take it all, you pig. Then he shoved this small brown bottle up my nose. And girl, I gotta tell you something. That quick snip of poppers lets the penis slide right in. The penis slide right in. Now I can take it with a grin. Just a quick snip of poppers lets the penis slide right in the most delightful way.
Good queer performers push their audiences forward into the future they desire. A good performance is utopia for a moment. In the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, all of these potential utopias were whirled away when the police stormed in. Performances interrupted, orgasms foregone, connections broken. The police brought their alternative performance. The police did not just want to stop what was happening, they wanted to make their own utopia for a moment. They pulled on their costumes and they put themselves to work on embodying authority, power, intimidation. As individual officers, people with homes and hobbies, they had been moved by some newspaper stories about a deadly sex craze and by others that spoke of a horrible illness killing men who had sex with each other. They heard the words of politicians who spoke about preserving families and protecting children. As individuals, they may even have wanted no more gay or queer people. As an organized group of individuals, each wanting to belong to something bigger than they were, police officers were grabbed by the idea of cutting the number of queer venues. All we have is the records of their group performance, the way they stopped gay and queer people. They arrested our futures, at least for a night or two. The story of these raids is a story from the past, but it is about how we live in the present, creating a future. In every moment we are performing, making choices about the future we want to build for ourselves and others. We can be inspired by other people who are better than us at articulating a future, but it is not some distant, formless thing. How we are living now is always creating a future, whether we like it or not. Whether or not we are trying, we are performing a future. As a genderqueer dancer stretches the limbs they have, they bring us into their utopia for a moment.
Wow, this stuff is amazing!
Yeah, let me try some. I've never done it before.
Wow, this is hot.
Shit.
Hey, Cookie, let's put something in my ass and see if it works.
I just jumped the whole thing on the carpet. Here, bend over, let me try this chair.
Oh my god, I can't even feel anything.
Oh shit, the whole thing fits.
Wow, the room is spinning right now. These are great, but you know what? You can't use them if you're taking Viagra.
Why?
Well, because you'll die.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Wow, this stuff is amazing. So this goes out to all the guys who are too concerned with size. It really doesn't matter anymore.
As you watch his manhood grow, shove that bottle up your nose. Relax,
relax
your hole,
your hole,
and slide down on that pole.
Just done. We spit the bubbles, pop the penis slide right in. The penis slide right in. You can take it with a grin. Just a quick spit the bubbles, pop the penis slide right in.
In the most delightful,
making it not frightful.
In the most delightful.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing, based on a person's sexual orientation, was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators' backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
When I return, Studio One forever.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Mark Saltarelli, hi, how are you?
Hey, Mark. It's a pleasure to meet you, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Mr. Bruce Valanche, hi, how are you?
Hi.
How are you, Mr. Bruce Valanche?
I'm frequently mistaken for Donna Kelsey, so I have to issue a disclaimer.
Oh, okay.
That's the look. It's the red hair, it's the blonde. I mean, the blonde hair, the red glasses.
Natural blonde.
Thank you.
I have to say thank you both for being here, to have your voices, your stories be heard by the LGBT community and beyond, especially to talk about your award-winning documentary, Studio One Forever. Studio One Forever. Mark, you are the director, you are the editor, you are a co-producer. Talk to me about essentially the legacy that you're telling in this documentary, and essentially what is that legacy that you're telling in your film?
Well, Studio One was one of the very first gay discos in America. It started in 1974 by this amazing guy, Scott Forbes, who was an optometrist who wanted to open a gay disco. And, you know, back in 1974, that was a pretty bold thing to do. But it survived. It went through the amazing excitement of the 70s, and then, of course, the 80s came, and the tragedy of the AIDS crisis went. And so it was an opportunity, really, to look at that whole era of LGBTQ history through the lens of this incredible club that provided a safe space for so many gay men, primarily. You know, and it wasn't without its issues. In the early days, it was very exclusive. Scott wanted only gay white men, and he had ways of keeping women out, like the no open-toed shoes policy, requiring multiple forms of ID. So we cover it all, warts and all. And And it's really a journey through LGBTQ history.
And Bruce, for yourself, how did you get involved in this project? Talk to me about the origins for yourself.
Look at Mark. He called me. Look at him. How could I say no? The truth is, I was, I'm old enough to have been there, as I say in the movie. If you were around in the 70s and you say you remember it, you weren't there. But I was, and I have snatches of it still come back to haunt me. So I used to work at Studio One in the back lot, which was a nightclub in the back. And that's where Broadway divas would come in, like Chita Rivera and Bernadette Peters, and they would do their shows. And a lot of the times I was writing those shows. So I was there on that mission. And occasionally I would wander into the across the DMZ into the disco in the front, where there were a lot of guys who didn't look like me, who were dancing and frolicking. And so I would kind of, mingle. I would try to navigate the dance floor. It was kind of like bringing the Queen Mary into a dock. And eventually I would go back to my space, the back lot. But it was interesting to watch these worlds collide, the world of big time cabaret and the gay community carrying on. It being Hollywood, there were big movie stars and big personalities for the first time mingling in what was essentially a gay environment and having a great time. So there was something very special was happening. And as the years went on, the place became a community center, more or less, for a gay community that had always gone out to places that were hidden because you were not allowed to be openly gay. And this was the first place where everybody was openly gay, and it was celebrated. So that became a focal point later on as the AIDS epidemic started. And it was a part of all of that. And that's what the movie shows, how the community grew and how in this particular community in West Hollywood, Studio One was a linchpin for all of that.
And Bruce, can you talk to me about the origins of the backlot, how Liza Minnelli, Chita Rivera, and a heart attack essentially got that space going? Can you talk to me about that?
Well, Chita was rehearsing the original production of Chicago that Bob Fosse was staging and with Gwen Verdon, and he had a heart attack. And they said, you can't work for 3 months. You just have to lay low and do nothing. So the show was postponed, and everybody was sitting around twiddling their very, very well-manicured thumbs. And Chita decided this would be a good time. Actually, somebody just decided for her, and she agreed that it would be a good time for her to do the nightclub act that she had always avoided doing because she was an actress, dancer. She was not hello, Cleveland. She was not that kind of a performer. So, but John Kander and Fred Ebb, who wrote Chicago, put it together for her. And Scott Forbes at the back lot realized this would be a great opening thing for the cabaret that he had envisioned. And, of course, when you open with a star like Chita, who was very well known in Hollywood, Hollywood turned out to see it. And it was the act where she introduced All That Jazz, because the show hadn't opened yet on Broadway, Chicago. So it was kind of a landmark thing. And once she was there, everybody wanted to play that room. It became the room to play. And it grew from that. And the acts that were booked there by Alan Eichler, who's one of our producers, were more and more unusual and interesting. Geraldine Fitzgerald, who was an actress, who would sing old songs and poetry and all that and was captivating. And was a great friend and colleague of Betty Davis, who had brought her to Hollywood originally. She brought Betty Davis to Studio One as an audience member to introduce her. And once that got into the media, the place was a mat. You couldn't keep people out of the back lot. You could keep them out of the disco, but you couldn't keep them out of the back lot.
Incredible, incredible history. Mark, this goes back to what, 2018?
2019.
Was there a moment, was there a flashpoint for you when you decided to make this documentary? Was there that moment?
My friend Clifford Bell introduced me to Lloyd Coleman and Gary Steinberg, who are in the film. They were backlot producers of Monday Night Live, and they were planning, actually the developer was planning to demolish the building and build a multi-billion dollar, you know, luxury hotel complex on the site. And I found out through Lloyd and Gary that that this was happening, number one, and that these two women, Kate and Chrissy, developed the Save the Factory, that's the building that Studio One was housed in, campaign to let everybody know that they're going to demolish this building and our history. And they actually developed a couple of years before I got involved, a 40-page document that had a lot of the people that I would go on to interview, and it read like a movie script almost. It was, you know, I had been there in the 80s, and I have my memories of going there and being overwhelmed by the fantasy world that it was. But I had no idea what happened before I got there. I had no idea about the incredible 70s and how it was sort of, you know, groundbreaking. And I always thought it was just the cheap ripoff of Studio 54. But the reality was that it was the inspiration for Studio 54. Halston and Steve Rubell actually were friends of Scott Forbes, the owner. They came, they saw it, and a couple of years later, Studio 54 came about. Of course, 54 was there for only about 2 years, and it was basically a crime scene. But Studio One was there for nearly 20 years, and it saw that entire period of time. And so we were working actually with the developer and had access to the building before it was going to be disassembled, but that's for the movie. And we started shooting interviews, and one of those interviews was Michael Koth, who I say is the heart of our film. He was the front bartender, and a lot of stars came to Studio One, and he was a star too. He was the first face that you would see for many years. And having him sitting there at his old station in this place, recounting his memories and his honesty and sharing his personal struggles and his story, I realized that we have something really special here. And so it was an evolution. You know, we slowly, thanks to Bruce and other people, found people. I think I went back to you, Bruce, at least 4 or 5 times. So we have multiple T-shirts. I should have coordinated costumes. You know, I wasn't thinking.
You see many hair colors, styles,
hair colors.
and weight levels in the movie.
And Bruce is just amazing. Of course, you know, he provides the majority of our comic relief. We all know that. But beyond that, he's an encyclopedia or Wikipedia, however you want to say it, of knowledge of Hollywood history, of LGBTQ history. And he's become my very good friend. And I don't know what the film would be like without Bruce. So I really appreciate it. So yeah, it was an evolution over years of finding the people. Some of them took a lot of work to try to convince them to be in the film, like Carol Taylor DiPietro. I had an amazing conversation early on with her for hours, and I knew that I had to have her in the film. She's a little bit shy, but she was actually the last interview we got, and I can't imagine what the film would be like without her.
She worked for Scott Forbes. She was his executive assistant, but she also worked at Disneyland. She was a Disney cast member, and this was her side hustle, working with Scott, selling poppers and records in the boutique.
She's responsible,
She's, of course, two things that go hand in hand, poppers and records, who knew?
And the mirrors with the little grooves in them. She won't say what that was for, but she's so cute. She's just adorable. One of my favorite lines is, "Poppers were very popular at Studio One." Coming out of her mouth, that's, to me, is hilarious. But I mean, she is responsible for the very first gay night at Disneyland, you know. Apparently, they had to hide it. And back in those days, Disney didn't realize that their biggest fan base was gay people. But she's the reason for all of that happening, and, you know, she should get her due for that.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell, and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is gay hip-hop artist, the Mangfather Bob Katz. An artist friend of mine recommended that I check out Mark Tara's Rainbow Country years ago, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Mark's excellent interviews highlight all aspects of the LGBTQ community, and he's not afraid to ask the difficult questions that other hosts avoid. And I love, love, love the music that Mark plays on Rainbow Country each week, especially when he plays my music. But seriously, Mark Tara has been such a supporter of my music and has turned me on to so many great LGBTQ artists that I'd never heard of before. I'm so grateful to Mark Tara's Rainbow Country.
If you are in the Toronto area, say in mid-November, I want to bring this to your attention. The 28th Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival runs November 13th to the 24th and features a unique blend of contemporary Asian cinema, videos, and presentations by artists from Canada, the US, and Asia, including the Arabic film Layla, a film about a struggling Palestinian drag queen who often finds creative ways to make ends meet. At a stuffy corporate event, Layla's performance goes terribly wrong, making their outrageous antics go viral. The 28th Toronto Real Asian International Film Festival runs November 13th to the 24th at the TIFF Lightbox. For more information, simply visit realasian.com. In June 2014, my team and I covered North America's first World Pride that happened right here in Toronto. The footage that we captured recently got turned into a documentary that's out right now. A Different Kind of Love is the name of the film and available on OutTV and OutTV Proud, which is also available on Apple TV, Amazon Prime Video, and other streaming platforms. I hope you'll take a little time to check it out. A Different Kind of Love. So in June this year, I won the Out Loud Best in LGBT Radio Programming from the NCRA, the National Community Radio Association. I received that award for my episode on Operation Soap, the bathhouse raids that took place in Toronto, February 5th, 1981. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond, heard on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as available as an edited podcast, if you think what I'm doing here is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the edited podcast, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry Rainbow Country. How can you do that? Simple. Simply head over to marktara.ca, new URL, marktara.ca, and hit the donations banner, because that's where you'll find all the outlets that carry Rainbow Country. A little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support be heard.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando, I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
I'm Sky Gilbert, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So, quote, the most exciting woman on earth, unquote. That's from legendary filmmaker Orson Welles when talking about actor and chanteuse Eartha Kitt. Here's another quote. Bruce, my love, where have you been since 1952? This is so, so Eartha, unquote. That is Eartha Kitt talking to Bruce Vilanch.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay, so Bruce Vilanch, you co-wrote the tracks on Eartha Kitt's 1984 album, I Love Men. I have that album. The vinyl,
baby.
I have it. Can you please tell me about the history of the iconic gay song, Where Is My Man?
Well,
because there's an interesting story behind that song.
In a nutshell, I wrote the first draft of a movie called Can't Stop the Music, which the Village People movie, from which I was fired when I asked for money after the third rewrite. But I somehow remained with the production. And Jacques Morali, who created the Village People, also did a thing in Paris every year for the Crazy Horse nightclub, which was where these Amazonian models with huge fake boobs would come out and lip sync to new songs recorded by famous people that Jacques knew. And he had Eartha, he'd made a deal with Eartha to do one of these songs, and he needed a song for her. And he called me and said, "Darling, I believe you can write lyrics." And he said, "The song is titled, Where Is My Man? I'm sending you the tape." And so I got the tape. And of course, I didn't know Eartha at that point, but I knew Eartha, you know. So I wrote the thing to her, and he sent it to her. And he said, "We have to give her a demo. She won't understand otherwise." So I recorded a demo, in which, of course, I did Eartha Kitt. You know, "I want a man who will kiss me and love me and all that stuff." And she got the demo, and she liked it very much. And she called me, and she said, "You do a very good impression of me. If I hear you are getting paid for it, I will kill you." So that was the beginning of the relationship. And then later on, when we were recording the thing, which we did in New York, she turned to me, and at one point she said, "Drew, where have you been since 1952? That 1952 was when she made her big breakthrough in the so-called New Faces, where she and Paul Lynde and Alice Ghostly were all in the show together. And Orson Welles knew her from when she was a dancer with Catherine Dunham at the Ballet Africain. He was always very, very smitten with her. And I think she was smitten with him, but I'm sure once they got together, they realized it was Clash of the Titans. And it was not meant to be more than a casual sort of thing. But, and then Eartha and I became friends, and we did the entire album, I Love Men, and it brought her back, really. I mean, she was sitting in Connecticut, not working, because she'd gotten into political trouble during the Johnson administration, and she'd gotten a lot of blacklists, and this brought her back as a disco star. And as I
I remarked, you know, after we'd made a lot of money, I said, Eartha Kitt really is my favorite 12 inches. It was all vinyl, you know. And it charted all over the world, but not in the States, because they wouldn't play disco. They wouldn't play disco songs on the radio back then. So they were in an anti-disco mood.
It was a worldwide top 10 hit. So yeah. Bruce, you are a multi-award-winning artist. You won two consecutive Emmy Awards for your writing on the Oscars, on the Academy Awards. You were doing that from what, 2000 to 2014?
Well, I did 25 Oscar shows, starting with the infamous Rob Lowe Snow White show, which I've written about in the book, which is now available for pre-order on Amazon. It's about all the television shows I wrote in the 70s that were disasters. And Can't Stop the Music is in there, too. It's called It Seemed Like a Bad Idea at the Time. So lots of funny stories. That's my side promotion here.
What was it like writing for the Oscars?
It's kind of like playing in the Super Bowl. I mean, you know that anything that's good, they will remember. And if it's terrible, it will live with you for the rest of your life, because it's the biggest show in the world. It's live. It goes all over the place. And so the pressure is on. Those two shows were Billy Crystal shows. The first one was the one where we famously jettisoned a lot of the script, because his co-star in City Slickers, Jack Palin, got up on stage and started doing one-arm push-ups when he won his Oscar. And so it was too good to resist. But what people don't realize is Jack Palin's first line in his acceptance speech was, Billy Crystal, I crap bigger than that. So the bar was set. It was set low, but the bar was set for us to come back with a lot of jokes. And we won an Emmy for essentially rewriting the show on the fly in the biggest show in the world. So they gave us an Emmy, and then they gave us an Emmy for the show next year, where we did a lot of jokes about the show the previous year. And I'm delighted. I've lost more Emmys than I've won. I've lost a whole bunch of Emmys.
Well done to you. Mark, we've been talking about films. We're talking about music. Music in your documentary. Talk to me about what that process was like to get some of those songs. You've got like Donna Summer's Dim All the Lights and others. What was that process like?
Well, that probably was the most difficult part of the entire process, and that's probably why it took so many years to finally get it finished. When I started putting it together, I kind of went a little crazy. I mean, I knew at some point we're going to have to deal with paying for all of this. And I think the first budget for the songs that I had was about, I don't know, $500,000. So obviously I had to find other ways. We have a lot of original songs, and that's all thanks really to Alan Eichler, who not only is an amazing part of the film, you know, he booked Geraldine Fitzgerald and had Betty Davis introduce her. And he came with all of these incredible photos. Anyway, fast forward, we had some fundraising screenings, and he was blown away by the film, and he said, I would like to help you. And indeed he did. And because of his incredible contribution, we were able to, you know, I had to reduce the budget considerably, obviously, but we were able to get the film finished. You mentioned Donna Summer. Originally, I wanted I Feel Love, but they wouldn't go for that for the rate we were going for. But they gave us Dim All the Lights, which is amazing as well. Some of the songs that we just couldn't afford, I have an amazing guy, Jake Simpson, who was a Star Search winner. He's gay. He lives in the Midwest, and he is a disco freak. He has a studio that has all of the original, you know, equipment from the era of disco music. And I would say, can you just create something that has kind of this feeling of a song? And within a day, he would be sending me this amazing piece of music. So without Jake's support, I don't know how we would have gotten this film done. And I defy anyone to tell me that, you know, it's not the original song in some cases, because of Jake's amazing work. Uh, so So yeah, it's been quite a process. But you know, after 4 years, we completed it, and finally it's out to the world. You know, streamable. And by the way, Eartha Kitt, there's an archival clip on the DVD and Blu-ray, if anybody still has those machines, on there, along with Cheetah Rivera's entire uncut interview, a lot of scenes that I had to delete, and an amazing commentary with me and Bruce and Stephen Israel of us babbling over the movie. So please watch the movie first, because yeah, you won't know what's going on otherwise.
So this movie covers some really, really amazing gay history. And the fact that, what was it, the film Tommy, the musical, had its premiere, I guess, after party there. Yeah. And you guys have the archival footage of that, and you've got like Diana Ross and all these, this sort of stuff. How, talk to me about, Mark, talk to me about the process of sourcing out all of those archival materials. What was that process like?
Equally difficult was that process. I have two incredible archival producers who worked with me. I don't know if they realized what they were getting into, but it took months. I mean, we have a spreadsheet that goes on for pages, because I went a little crazy, you know. I mean, the movie goes by at a quick clip. And each of those stills, each of those clips had to be either declared fair use from an attorney, or we had to pay for them. And they had to be sourced, they had to be, you know, it was just an amazingly difficult process. I mean, I knew that making a documentary film with a lot of archival would be difficult, but I guess I didn't understand it completely, or I may not have taken this job on. But because of Alexandra Margolin and Austin Wilkin working with me and not giving up, we got through it. And actually, most of it was declared fair use. We had to pay for a few things, but I'm just proud that I didn't give up, because there were moments when it became overwhelming, and I wasn't sure if we would ever be able to make the money that we needed to get this finished. But I'm so glad I didn't, because the response has been amazing.
And Bruce, for yourself, you were there. You worked at the back lot, going back and being part of this project, how was that for you? Was it cathartic? What was it like reliving some of those moments?
Well, it was wonderful. I mean, I hadn't thought about a lot of it in a long time. But I realized I was a part of it all. But with the clips you mentioned, actually, interestingly enough, both of those things were Alan Carr Productions. I mean, Alan managed Anne Margaret, and so when the Tommy people went to him and hired him to promote the movie, because he was an ace promoter, and he organized that premiere at Studio One. And of course, he also shot part of Can't Stop the Music at Studio One, because he was a big fan of Studio One, because he would find people that he could wrestle with later on whenever he showed up. So he was, and he's kind of, you know, fallen out of favor because he produced that infamous Rob Lowe Oscar show that I wrote, but not that part. But so I was reliving all of that. I mean, there's a picture of in the documentary of me and Alan and Patrick Swayze at the Oscars, I think. But Swayze came to Studio One as well. So it was kind of liberating. I was thinking, well, I did have fun. You go back and you just remember the stuff that didn't work out, and you forget about the stuff that actually was good. And it's good.
And it's also part of the documentary, but there was a reunion that was, yeah, that I guess when they were talking about demolishing the building. How did the reunion come about? Was that because of the film, or because of the potential loss of the site?
Yeah, the reunion was sort of what was the hook for me in many ways, because it provided an event. It was already planned. It was in the works, but it sort of became kind of our set for the movie as we went along. And I always knew that that would be our third act, you know, bringing all these people back. And we couldn't have hoped for a better outcome of the reunion. They actually gave away free tickets to everybody, and not expecting that many people to show up. But literally everybody showed up. And I think it was 2 hours delayed. So I had plenty of time to go through the line waiting outside and to help people not be so angry for waiting around, and find all of the people who would be or were a part of the film and have them do a little kind of recap of what we've seen, and to just get from other people, you know, what the place meant to them. And it meant so much. And even if it was delayed for 2 hours, people didn't really complain once they got in. It was just a joyous celebration. The dance floor was opened up again. We had Thelma Houston saying goodbye with "Don't Leave Me This Way." And we covered it all, and it was the perfect third act for our film. And it was beautiful.
Mark, I asked this question to Bruce in the process of, you know, researching this project and making this project. You were obviously reliving your time there. You were saying in the 80s. What was it like for you to relive some of those moments when you were there?
Well, I came out in Illinois at the University of Illinois, a small college town. Came to LA and I went to Loyola Marymount. I couldn't get into USC, but Loyola is an amazing film school. And I, like everybody at that time, heard about Studio One. You know, it was in the gray rags with full-page ads with half-naked guys. And so every weekend, not every weekend, but most weekends, I would travel to West Hollywood. And I was rather shy, so I wasn't the guy that ripped his shirt off and started joining the mob. But I loved just watching it. And so those were my memories. And of course, I went through the 80s and a lot of my friends were dying as well. And that's really an important part of this film. Not only the joy and the freedom that it provided, but it became almost a sacred space. It hosts the first AIDS fundraiser for APLA. Was hosted by Joan Rivers, and Melissa Rivers does an incredible interview about her mom. And so it's the joy and the pain that the movie kind of brings together. You know, all of the interviews, you know, would basically go the same way as the film does. You know, the first part is happiness and joy and freedom, and then, like it happened back then, we're hit with this thing, this AIDS crisis, and everybody's dying. And and somehow the dance footage represents both the joy and the pain in such a beautiful way. And it's cathartic. All of the interview subjects would ultimately, when we get to AIDS, which I always save for last, would break down and have a catharsis, because it's still there. I mean, like Gypsy said last night, the forever in the title is the most important word in the title, because those days stay with people. It's a PTSD, and that's why this ugly building meant so much to so many people, and why they banded together and tried to save it from just being demolished, and taught the developer, you know, what the building represented to the survivors of this lost generation. As John Duran, the former mayor of West Hollywood, says, you know, in this very tiny little area of West Hollywood, over 10,000 people died. You know, it was, as Bruce says, our own kind of Holocaust. And it's important to remember. I think the reason the history was kind of lost possibly is because, you know, it was too painful to remember for so long. and people kind of wanted just to let it go away. But because of this amazing group of people who agreed to, you know, share their honesty, the stories, you know, Michael Koth, his honesty about his addiction problems. You know, at first, his addiction was all about having a great time, but then the 80s rolls around and it became, I have to have this just to block out what was happening during those times. And it kind of brings maybe a little bit more understanding about what we went through. And, you know, obviously for people who went through that period, that's the main core audience. But, you know, even I forget the way the world was back then, you know, because we've come so far so quickly. But mostly I really hope that the younger generation of LGBTQ people who are kind of reaping the benefits of what our forefathers went through, the fight and even dying to get the rights we have, I really hope that they can see it. And the people, the young guys who have, are really moved by it. And they tell me that, you know, I had no idea what you guys went through. And you guys seem so much more connected than we are today. And it's true, you know, they're watching their 30-second TikTok videos. And if they're at a bar, you know, they're on the phone. That's not really connecting with people. So I hope they will take 90 minutes and, you know, get a little understanding of what happened.
So I just have a handful of minutes left with the two of you. And so here's my last question. So Studio One Forever, it did a really successful film festival run, won a number of awards, Best of Fest, Best LGBTQ Film, Best Documentary. Bruce, what do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen Studio One Forever?
If they didn't realize there was a community before, they do now after seeing it. And I think that they realize that there's more to it than just boom, boom, boom and hedonism. And the generation that, of course, has grown up with people not dying of AIDS, so because there is a cocktail that they can take to prevent it, or to ameliorate it, but they don't realize what went on before. They don't realize the struggle that the generation before them had, and I think that they will come away with an education and a sense of what the joy was all about. And what the loss was, and how we replenish ourselves afterwards. I mean, I think that's what they go thinking it's going to be a movie about, like the Studio 54. It's going to be about famous people doing face plants on the dance floor, but in fact, it's about a whole lot more than that. It's about joy and loss and community and building and all of that.
And Mark, for yourself, I just have a couple minutes left. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen your amazing award-winning documentary, Studio One Forever?
Yeah, I hope that, you know, again, the younger generation will find it and take the time to watch it. We actually have an educational distributor added to our distributor, and we hope to get it into universities. And it can be a tool for, you know, I always say, what Studio One did was we were the other, and Studio One merged the Hollywood community with the gay community for the first time, as far as I can tell. And, you know, when you get to know people as human beings rather than a stereotype, they are not the other anymore. They are humans. And that's what I really hope, that people can have an understanding of our community as human beings, and you know, in this moment right now, as things seem to be going backwards, it's important to remember what happened and how we got to the place we are before it goes away again.
Well said, well said. Mark Saltarelli, Bruce Valange, well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The documentary Studio One Forever is available on Apple TV, Amazon Prime Video, and other streaming platforms. For more on the film's director, simply visit marksaltarelli.com. For more on funny person Bruce Valanche, including how to pre-order his upcoming book, it seemed like a bad idea at the time, simply visit wegotbruce.com.
Hi, everyone. This is Mark Tewksbury, Olympic champion, leader, humanitarian. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, Found It, Irene Cara.
Hey, students. Have you stumbled in your course and want a fresh start? Well, At the Best University has your back. AU offers more than 850 courses that align to your program, so you can retake your course online, turn that grade around,